Hey guys, it's me, Gabrus. I'm on a tour of the JPL right now, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Yeah, maybe you saw it in the film The Martian, or maybe you heard of it in that they build spaceships and rovers and shuttles and land all kinds of stuff here. And this has been a really exciting tour. It's not even done yet, but I'm going to get to sit down and talk to Dr. Farah Alibay after this, and I'm super excited about that. So, all right, hold on. We're moving on to Cassini. Got to go figure out what that is. See you guys later.
That was definitely an E-ticket.
Roger that, Sally.
So I just finished my tour at JPL, and the woman who gave me the tour is willing to sit down and talk to me and answer my stupid questions about her smart job. So, Dr. Farah Alibay, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
You're welcome.
I'm so excited. The tour was fantastic. That was awesome. And it was even cooler than I thought it would be. And I had high hopes, which is so weird.
Oh, for like so a usually people tour. come to JPL and they're like, I didn't know you guys had things here. And I'm like, really? Like, what?
It was more cool stuff than I thought there was going to be. I knew that the conversation, like, I was excited to just hear what you guys, well, what you had to say. And then some other scientists joined us, which was exciting. But I had no idea the kind of stuff we would get to see.
Yeah, and you didn't even see half of it.
Right.
You guys were there after hours, and we're not building these spacecraft right now.
Right.
So usually we have actual spacecraft in our high bay.
Oh, man. Guys, don't let her get you down. What I saw was awesome.
Well, also, if you live in the LA area, we have an open house every October.
Yeah.
It's a open weekend. You can come and see the lab. And they actually have tours. If you happen to visit, they have tours every Monday that you can sign up for.
Every Monday. And then October is an open month.
Yeah, it's an open weekend. So
open
the
weekend.
Open weekend, they have like extra displays and everything's nice and pretty.
There's more stuff going on.
But yeah, because one of the things that NASA does, well, we use your taxpayers' money, right? Thank you.
I don't pay any taxes.
Okay.
All my money is that. Offshore. All 50 bucks is in a Bahamian bank account.
Oh, God. But yeah, one of our missions is to educate the public.
I feel like that's something, well, we can get into it more and more, but why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself and what your title is at JPL, and what is JPL? I mean, I know, but maybe the listeners don't. I know now.
Well, I'm a systems engineer, which means nothing to a normal person.
But what is that? Well, if you knew someone who knew a little bit about science, what would you say?
So one thing that I always say is that I'm a jack of all trades, but master of none. Right?
Okay.
So basically, when you build a spacecraft, it's this big giant beast, and it's really complex. And you'll have an expert in each of what we call a subsystem, right? So there'll be someone in charge of thermal, making sure the spacecraft stays the right temperature. There'll be a power person who will make sure you have enough energy, a structure person that build a structure around it, telecom person that does the radio. And my job basically is to get them to play nice with each other. They end up sharing resources, right? So when you launch a spacecraft, you have a maximum amount of mass that you can
right,
launch.
Right, you can't. Right? It has to be a certain weight.
Yeah,
it has to be a certain
size. Because
your
rocket can only take so much, right? And so it has to be a certain size, a certain volume. You end up being limited on energy every time. There's always, so different instruments will want different amounts of power.
And you got to be like, hey, look, we need to knock down a couple of kilojoules from the thermal unit and give a couple of these. I'm using a term I made up. I think.
Well, it's all in watts, but yeah.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, basically it's like, I have to go to people and be like, hey, so like, can you give me like a kilogram back? Because like, we don't fit.
Oh,
and so
I
they'll
see,
try and figure out. And I'm like, are you sure you really need to have this on for like 2 hours? Can you have it on for an hour and a half? Like, can we do that? And so that's,
really cool. So you're kind of like managing, I guess, the system. You're engineering the system overall.
So basically I have to know enough about each little part that I can be like, I know you're bullshitting me. Like,
right.
Come on. Like,
come on, lose a pound. give me a couple of watts. I need a couple of watts back.
So I know you can do better.
The thermo guys, they're up my ass right now. Can we fix this, please?
But I will do that. I'd be like, hey, so like this guy, like he really needs a lot of power. Like, can you help me out?
Yes.
So like part of it is sort of being a people person and knowing what you're talking about, but and being willing to learn when you don't know.
Right. And that was another thing I was surprised by was you wouldn't think that system engineers or people who work at NASA or JPL are capable of giving tours, like you assume a certain stereotype to a scientist who's like, no, you should be chained to your desk just typing numbers with like a long ashy cigarette hanging out of your mouth. And then between you and the other two scientists who joined us, everyone was so charming and extroverted and shared so much information.
Pretty normal. I mean, you didn't see the strange ones.
Right, the strange ones, they're the ones
changing. They don't come out.
Yeah, they're like, let's put Farah out there. If we're going to have anyone talking to the public, let's make it Farah, not those like the guy with the tinfoil hat on.
Oh, there is one guy that used to come to lab every day with a lab coat on. I think he's at Google now. I haven't seen him around. I think
he wore a lab coat.
But yeah, and there's like guys that wear shorts every single day. But yeah.
Yeah, I think and one of the other guys on the tour had like flip-flops and a like Rage Against the Machine t-shirt on or something. Yeah.
But it feels like college a lot.
Walking around, I felt like I was on like
a campus
that was in the 1950s. Because there's like this, stylistically, it's like that Tomorrowland, Disney World kind of design. And the font is so, like, it's like a future, like, it's like retro futurist or like neo futurist.
Yeah, it's like it would have been the future, like, if you were in the 50s looking forward to the 70s.
Right?
And then
like
we just didn't have more money to make it better.
So. Right. But then when you go into a room and that there's a, you know, $35 million rover inside of it, you're like, oh, okay, that's a little different.
Yeah.
That's the future.
Yep,
that's
yep,
very
yep.
present.
I was down at Johnson Space Center, which is in Houston, a few months ago for a meeting, and they took us around like the...
And listeners might know the Houston Space Station from Houston.
We have a problem.
that's the titular Houston in that situation.
That is why... So JPL, you saw this when you were on the tour, but JPL does navigation for all the unmanned spacecraft, right? When we have the DSN. And Houston really does the navigation. They have the mission control for the manned missions. So there's some done at KSC, which is Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Mm-hmm. They have like mock-ups of each of the capsules there, and they had a Soyuz rocket. Soyuz, just the capsule that you sit in. Apparently the seats in there, they custom make them to your butt. So that, like, because they have so little space that they have to save all the mass.
Yeah, right.
Can.
They're not going to leave a centimeter or an inch on
and
either
then
side.
Like, someone was like, yeah, and it's actually a problem for astronauts because they can't put on any weight. Like, and I was like, oh, like, you mean like when you buy a wedding dress? And I was the only girl in the room, the only unmarried person, the only girl in the room. And they're like, oh God, did I just say that?
Did I just say the most rom-com thing
I
could say?
I was like, oh God, like I'm trying to break stereotypes and I just said that. No.
Oh, I get it. Like wedding dresses. Oh God.
Of course she said that.
Ladies be shopping.
But they found it funny.
So what did you study? What was your area? How'd you get into this whole thing, if you want to give me that spiel?
I was born in the late 80s, right? So it was still when being an astronaut was cool.
Yeah.
And the shuttle program was still very much going. I think I was born right before the Challenger accident. So I wanted to be an astronaut. I'm French-Canadian. When I was in primary school, there was actually a French-Canadian astronaut called Julie Payette, who was kind of my idol. She was like the first.
Oh, a female too.
Yeah. That's and like. So she's like French-Canadian female astronaut, right? And she was like the rage.
Yeah, I never saw a fat astronaut, so I never had someone to look up to. Like, someday. And then when you just kind of explain, hey, I need a kilogram here, I'd be like smirking in the corner, like, I think I should get a salad.
But growing up, I realized that I was really good at physics and chemistry. Well, physics and math and chemistry. And actually never wanted to be an engineer because my dad was an engineer, but he's a robotics and electrical engineer. And I was like, no, I'm not going to do what he's doing. Like, no, right? Like, especially my mom's two brothers and her sister are all computer scientists.
Oh,
so everyone's an engineer in my family. And I was just like, I can't do this, right? I was like, I'm going to be a doctor. I'm Indian, right? Like, as in like originally. And so like, Indian people.
You're a complicated individual. You're telling me you're both Indian, French, Canadian, American,
and
a woman, and British. That last one's a lie.
Well, yeah. No, it's not. No. I was born in Canada, but I grew up in England. But originally, we're all Indian, although my parents were born in Madagascar. That's like a quick story.
Needless to say.
So I wanted to be a doctor for a while, and then realized that I hated biology.
Like a medical doctor.
Yeah.
Because you are a doctor now.
I am a doctor.
But if someone says, there's a doctor, is there a doctor in the house? You don't raise your hand.
No. In fact, like when I first got my PhD, I like signed up for like Southwest bonus points or whatever. And you know, you put in your title. And I thought about putting doctor because I was like, hey, you know, I worked hard for this. And I was like, but this is an airplane. Like if they call me, like, I can fix your airplane. That's fine. Can't really save a human life.
Call me if equipment malfunctions.
Yes, and, that, or then I can deal with it.
If you need some wattage in the front part of the ship, I can help you out.
But yeah, anyway, I discovered I hated biology and that really I was meant to be an engineer.
And so despite...
I got over it. I realized it was different enough.
So what do you study for this?
So I actually... have a degree in aerospace engineering. So my undergraduate and master's are both in aerospace engineering, but I was actually doing air breathing propulsion. So I went to undergrad.
Air breathing propulsion?
Meaning airplane stuff.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Oh.
So for us, because rockets don't use air, right? So we don't have turbines.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So I actually went to Cambridge in England. They didn't really have...
Heard of it.
Yeah, even that small school over there. Like, I think Newton went there. Like, I don't know. I heard he, like, made some really big discoveries. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I'll tell you what. He's a terrible roommate.
Oh, gosh.
He never stocks the fridge.
He also apparently used to leave the blinds closed all the time. That's how he discovered the light diffraction.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, just watch Cosmos. Neil deGrasse Tyson will explain this.
It's funny
for you.
That you watch Cosmos. You're like, oh, yeah, maybe I could brush up on science real quick.
Well, Carl Sagan's Cosmos is like one of my favorite TV series of all time.
So. That makes sense to me. Like, that's fair. Yeah. I hate to use The Martian as a reference because it's a piece of pop culture, but it is about... I can watch Matt Damon do anything, you know, including baked potatoes.
And plus JPL saves the day, so just saying.
Well, that's... I was not familiar with the acronym JPL until that scene. And so for me, that movie just kind of opened up ideas. And then that moment when the Chinese are like... Well, if we give them this information, we're revealing that we're ahead in some capacity. And then let's make this a deal. Science, scientist to scientist. That I'm getting chills talking about it right now, to be honest. Like, you could see the forearm hairs are standing up. I just think that's such an interesting thing where it's like, forget all politics. These are scientists that are up there. We can rescue him. We have the ability to help out. And like, I love that about scientists, that it's like science comes before everything
Else.
Well,
actually, I think I maybe mentioned this, but there's such a thing as space law, and the UN has these treaties, and there's one called the Space Treaty. And if I recall properly, there is one part of the treaty that says that, for example, if an astronaut was to crash on Earth or have a problem and any nation can help them, they're sort of bound by that treaty to help then astronauts. So when it comes to space, it's kind of cool. Actually, The Martian kind of shows that it does really transcend boundaries, right? Because space belongs to all of us and nations actually do tend to work together. For example, there was an Indian mission called MOM that was launched last year and it got to Mars a few months ago. MAVEN did, so maybe 6 months ago. And actually, JPL is doing the navigation for them. So we work with them. We have instruments that come from Europe all the time. We work with the Italians on telecom systems, right? We told you about the Galileo.
Right, because that's something that they have and that they can, that technology that they can share and scratch my back, scratch your back. It's all in the greater pursuit of knowledge
and then
exploration.
So we'll say, like, okay, we'll share some data with you if we can. And that's what it is. It's because... At the end of the day, like, if we find life on another planet, right, it's going to change humanity.
Right. Despite what, like, movies would have you believe that scientists, like, a government agent would be like, no, we must harness this for us. We can make money off of it. Like, that's always the premise of a movie. It's like, scientists make a discovery. It's like, well, we keep it under wraps. We can militarize this. Yeah. You know, it's like
One good thing to know about NASA is that we actually are bound by law to release science data.
That's another part of The Martian. Right?
Yeah, so we have a certain amount of time where we can keep the data, and it depends on the mission, and you negotiate it because, you know, one of the things is if you're a scientist working on a mission, and often you'll work on one or two missions in your life, you want to be the one publishing the paper, right? Like, if you worked on the instrument, built the instrument, like, helped with the mission, you know, it's only fair that you get to see the results first and write the paper. So that's why there's a buffer, because that gives people time to publish the papers.
Yeah,
But after that, everything's public. So, like, if you think that, you know, things are a hoax, you can literally go to the internet and download, like, pictures of Apollo.
Right.
There's actually, like, they released high-definition pictures of Apollo. It's amazing recently.
Oh, that's so cool.
And you can get them all. I can send you the link.
That's awesome. So let's talk a little bit more about what you're doing now at JPL, or what your projects are that you're allowed to talk about. I know there's top secret shit we can't get into.
It's not top secret. Yeah. So the reason why there's some things I can't talk about is because JPL, or NASA in general, has two ways of doing missions, right? There's times that Congress will tell us, write it into law, say, thou shalt do this mission, Right. And so
that's awesome. It's written into law.
Yeah,
like really, this year by law, JPL has to do this thing.
Yeah.
Can you give an example of a project people might?
We're launching a mission to Europa.
Which is one of Jupiter's moons?
It is.
Yes.
I
paid attention. Is that your favorite moon? No, right?
No, Enceladus is my favorite.
I knew you had a favorite moon.
Yes, that's a thing. And maybe the background on my phone. Yeah, so Europa is one of the moons of Jupiter, and it's a really great astrobiology target. And astrobiology is basically, if you decompose the world, right, it's basically finding life on the
in space. Yeah. And why is it a good astrobiology?
We believe that it has a notion. There's actually a movie also based on Europa. What's it called?
I believe it's called The Europa Report, to be honest, because I saw it on Netflix.
They actually like do really well up until like the last 10 minutes. So if you like, just turn off the movie 15 minutes before the end, you're fine. Actually, there's a bunch of JPL like engineers that helped with the movie. But the thing with Hollywood is, I have friends who are writers and they do this. They'll sit down with me and ask me questions, and then they'll think about it, and then they'll like make the movie, and then they're like, oh yeah, but like, this doesn't work, so we're just going to ignore physics right now. And
right.
I'm like, really? But
right. Well, that's what I remember they were talking about when they talked about the film Interstellar, which I loved as well. I'm a big fan of movies that just like demonstrate science.
That one was good until he fell in the black hole. And then I was like, if it had ended there, it would have been amazing.
Right.
But no, there had to be something like about love.
Right. Well, that's like, exactly. It's like, that's the fourth dimension is love.
Why? And then there's all these things that didn't make sense afterwards. And I was just like, why didn't you just stop?
Right. And that's what I was going to bring up is like, and then I remember hearing like in an interview, it's like, we had some scientists consult on this movie. I'm like, they would have said like.
But actually there's some things about the movie that are like incredibly accurate. So for example, so there was a Caltech scientist who worked on the movie. And you know, when you see the depiction of a black hole, he actually ended up publishing a few papers out of that because the movie gave him enough funding to go spend the research time.
To like imagine what the inside, to study.
Well, it's actually based on real data. And so it's our best depiction right now of what a black hole looks
like.
That's
so cool.
So that's really awesome. And actually they did a really good job with, you know, when they were saying like, oh, if we land, we'll like age. And the idea of space travel, right?
Yeah.
Like traveling faster than the speed of light and through wormholes. And so, by the way, telecom through wormholes, I'm not sure that works.
Yeah, you can't really.
but you know, the idea of really explaining how the aging process works, that's the first time that I've seen
cool.
it explained.
Yeah.
And like for a layperson, like even for me, I don't always get it, right? So it's really cool that he explained that really well. So they do
I love that moment when they come back up and forgive me for just saying the actor as the black guy, but the black scientist is on the ship and he's got like gray hair and gray beard. I was like, oh, fuck, that much time.
Yeah.
And then he's like a little weird now because he's clearly only been talking to a robot for like that long. I'm like, that's wild.
Yeah. So they did a good job of that.
That's awesome. So
I don't work on Europa, but Europa is one of the missions that got written into law, right?
Yeah.
And so obviously NASA and, you know, we have headquarters, for example, they influence what kind of missions we'll do. But that one was like basically Congress saying, you shall build this mission. And it's JPL and APL, which is the Applied Physics Laboratory over in Maryland.
Oh, okay.
So we work together on that one. So there's those types of missions. And then there's also what we call competed missions. So every couple of years, again, it'll be Congress or it'll come from NASA headquarters. They'll say, okay, hey guys, like if we give you $400 million, what could you do?
And then people pitch on it.
Yeah.
Sort of like, now this is a element of business I can wrap my head around because that's, what's it called? RFP, request for product or request for pitches, where it's like, hey, here's our budget.
We actually call them RFPs.
No, yeah. It's here's our budget. Here's, why don't you tell us what you would, if we gave you $250 million, what would you guys do with it?
Yeah.
JPL gets in a huddle and is like, well, we could finally do this thing, whatever that might be.
Exactly.
Oh, so those are the things you're not allowed to share
because
if someone else finds it out.
It's just like, you're not going to tell everyone, you know, what your next pitch is going to be.
Right, exactly. It's like, I'm actually working on a movie that, okay, steal this idea if you want, but here it is.
So that's why you know some of that stuff I work on cool stuff that I can't really talk about eventually one day. Sometimes there's papers published on it. But one of the cool missions that I'm working on right now is called ARM, which is the asteroid redirect mission.
Tell me you got a bunch of oil drillers that have no space experience that you need to get to. One of them's dating the daughter of the other guy. No, it's not that kind of
when I introduce myself, sometimes I want to say like, yeah, I'm like pretty much female Bruce Willis, but I'm not. I wish I was.
I wish I was female Bruce Willis.
Well, except better looking, hopefully. And like younger and actually knows what I'm doing. But.
Yeah, ideally you're all
you know, with all of these things.
But, that's just several caveats.
But like you told me to put this in layperson.
Right, this is for the layman.
But yeah, so we're going to start capturing, we're capturing this boulder and then we're going to bring it back to lunar orbit. So it's a distant retrograde lunar orbit or something looking like that. And it's a stable orbit around the moon. So there's no way we could impact the Earth.
And then there you can study it.
Well, no, even better. From there, we're going to send astronauts, and they're going to go up to the rock and like mine it and bring stuff back.
And they're going to go inside the rock and find out what's
on
in
it. Yeah.
On it, yeah. But they're going to bring stuff from inside. Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Why such a premium on wanting to know what's in an asteroid? Because it's just something we don't know a lot about.
Well, so there's multiple reasons for this mission. And actually, one of the other things that we're doing is while we're at the asteroid, after we've captured the boulder, we're going to do something called a gravity tractor.
I think I know what this is. So you fly above the Millennium Falcon and suck it into your...
No! No. So one of the things that we do at NASA, and we actually care about you guys, is something called planetary defense. So there's always this joke, right, that basically because the dinosaurs died because of an asteroid, and if they were to come back today, they'll be like, well, where's your space program at? Because that's why we all died, right? Armageddon, getting back to that one. So it's a real threat, right? That one day there could be an asteroid.
There could be one that is coming towards us, yeah.
But the good thing is that we are looking at the sky all the time. We have actually mapped a lot of these asteroids, and we study their orbits. And so if there was something big enough to destroy the planet, we would see it coming, right? So it wouldn't be like Armageddon.
It wouldn't just
there's
be
small ones
all of a
that we could
like,
miss that could make you know that could damage things, but the big ones we see them coming, right? That they're big enough. I mean, like the Armageddon one, you could see it with a telescope,
right?
Like, it's big. So it's like, come on, guys. Again, this is when Hollywood people don't listen to us because it doesn't work for their plot.
Right, right. Guys, we have 3 months. It's like, well, let's send up oil drillers. It's like, wait. How come we weren't watching?
It's like, we told you guys this, but anyway. Basically, we're using gravity. So basically, when you have two bodies in space, they attract each other. So even when you're on
Earth.
When you have
two bodies on Earth, they attract each other. Am I right? Sorry. God. She just pepper sprayed me, and she was correct in doing that.
Technically, you're attracted by the Earth, right? But you also pull on the Earth a little bit because you have mass.
Right.
You probably more than I do.
I mean, ouch. I deserve that.
But because the Earth is so massive, it doesn't really feel.
Right. Well, you don't have any effect on it.
Yeah. But if you have two bodies that have very similar masses, then they can attract each other. So in our case, if we're going to an asteroid, if we're massive enough, we can very slowly disrupt its orbit. And the great thing about that is that it only disrupts it a little bit, but it's very precise. And so the nice thing is, you know, there's different ways of changing an asteroid's orbit. But if you have a lot of time, if you know, for example, that this asteroid, if we propagate the orbit by like 1,000 years or 1,000,000 years, eventually it'll impact the Earth. You can change its orbit by a tiny little bit.
Yeah, like a tenth of a degree, and it will miss the Earth.
Oh, yeah, even less than that.
Yeah, even less than that, right. 100.
And 1,000. We have the ability to propagate these orbits. So that's something that we could do to save the Earth.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
There's other ways of, you know, you could just bomb it. And you could just, like, you know, push it with something really big.
Right.
And that will change its orbit. The problem with those things is that, well, if you bomb it, the little leftover pieces are going to go all over the place, so you don't know.
And if you push it without measurement, it hits the moon, or it hits the...
Yeah, or like you could push it and you know, you don't know how hard you pushed it, and so it's less, you know, a dire situation, that's what you would do, but if you have more time, you would do something like a gravity tractor.
Oh, that's awesome. What is your favorite moon again?
Enceladus.
And that's on Jupiter as well?
No,
that's one of Saturn's moons, right?
So Saturn's the next one along, the one with the rings on it?
Yes, that I know. And why is it your favorite?
Because it's also a really great astrobiology target. It's actually much smaller than Europa.
Is it the geyser one?
Yes.
It is.
It has geysers.
Right.
So it's a small, tiny moon. It's covered in ice. It has what we think is global oceans underneath and a core. But at the South Pole, there's these cracks called the Tiger Stripes. And there's like these cold geysers, essentially. They actually found recently, because we have a spacecraft at Saturn called Cassini.
We learned about Cassini at JPL.
Yeah. And Cassini is reaching the end of its mission. You'll have to look up how long it's been up there because I don't want to say the wrong, you know, I think it's been 10 years.
But it's been a while.
I think it's been 10 years this year.
Oh, wow.
2015, it was 10 years. And then it has another 2 years-ish to go. It's gone way past what we ever thought it would do. But it did its last close flyby of Enceladus. It was about 50 kilometers above the ground. Yeah. When it's so small, you don't have, and there's no atmosphere, it's a lot easier to navigate. It's like, you know what, like, I don't know how many light minutes away, but it's easy to navigate. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, that seems so crazy. I can't even barely parallel park and people are navigating something that's like five planets away.
But they actually found that it was curtains of water that are coming out of Enceladus at the South Pole.
That's wild.
And so, yeah. So the really cool thing about it is that, so with Europa, you know, Europa's great, right? But if you really want a sample from the ocean, you're going to have to drill, right? And we actually are thinking about landing something to get a sample from the surface.
Right, because it's below the surface as well.
Yes, the ocean is below the surface, yes. So they think there's some cracks, and we don't know. There might be stuff coming out. We're not sure because we haven't been that close to Europa. But Enceladus has this water spewing out, and the water's coming from inside.
You kind of just need to, like, roll down your window and put a cup out.
No, but literally that's what we want to do. Like, that is the best analogy for it. Like, literally what we want to do is fly a mass spectrometer, which, you know, and a better one than Cassini has, because Cassini didn't know what kind of biology we were going to be looking at. Right.
And also went up in 05.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So now that we sort of know what's up there, we want to know if there's complex organic molecules, which could be an
energy. Signs of life.
Yes. Because we know it has energy and we know it has water. And so that's life that we understand.
Right.
And so we're like, oh, well, maybe there's organic molecules, right? So we want to fly a mass spectrometer and literally just catch some of it and look at it. And I mean, if there happens to be a fisheye, then we'll know there's life.
But right.
That would kind of be like the holy grail.
But like this blink.
It's like, oh, I'm still waiting for that one on Mars. But, yeah. But yeah, so that's what's really cool about Enceladus.
That's so wild. Yeah. You said something there that made hairs on the back of my neck stand up, so I just want to go back to it for a second. I said signs of life, and you were like, yeah, you use something like
life as we know it.
Life, yeah, like you were like, oh, water and organic compounds means life as we know it, meaning that there's possibilities of types of life that we can't wrap our heads around.
And actually, well, not even just that. Well, there's that, like, life that's completely different to what we understand, but there's actually, even if you just go to the Saturn system, there's another moon out there called Titan. Right? Mm-hmm. And I told you about the Huygens probe that landed on Titan.
Yes.
So Titan is a completely different beast. It's a much bigger moon. It has an atmosphere, but it's got methane. It's got lakes of methane. It rains methane.
That's disgusting. Right?
Like, crazy, but
but things can live in methane.
It has weather.
Yeah.
It has clouds. And I'm not a Titan expert because I really like Enceladus. And I'm an engineer, so I like pick one. I was actually like in a study this week and we were doing stuff on Enceladus and stuff on Titan. And I was like all gone pro for Enceladus. And then I had to turn around to the scientist and be like, hey, so like, what's up with Titan?
Hey, what's Titan's deal?
So can you tell me why it's cool? Like, maybe I'll care about it more. It's actually really cool. So yeah, they have these huge lakes. Like, the lakes are the size of the Great Lakes.
Jeez.
Right? But methane lakes. So, you know, we don't really have life on Earth. Well, we're actually finding on Earth, actually, because of what we're doing on, you know, what we're trying to discover on these other planets, we're actually finding analogs on Earth, and we're finding life in places where we didn't think life could exist. And actually, I read an article the other day where it's the opposite. They found an area on Earth where there was no life, right? You would, you know,
where you would think that there should be life.
Yeah, yeah. Or like, I mean, you'd think like no life, you know, we found life in weird places on Earth.
Right.
But this place was the opposite, where like there was no life and we don't know why, but there's characteristic about it that like, maybe will tell us like why there may or may not be life when you go to other planets. Right.
And maybe there's life not as we know it in this area.
Yeah.
Oh God, that's such a fun expression. I'm overusing it already.
But yeah, so with Titan, it wouldn't be life, you know, the same biology as we know, because it would be methane-based life.
Right.
But
which
it doesn't
is totally
mean that
possible.
They, but it doesn't mean that there couldn't be life, right? So they still have energy and they have an atmosphere. So it's actually another great astrobiology target.
Oh, that's awesome. Now, I'm going to downshift a little away from science for a minute, because I'm always very intrigued, as well as people who are tops in their field and do these high-end professions. I'm always very curious if they do things for fun, or do you guys do anything at JPL? Is there anything that's like fun or recreational or extracurricular that everyone is part of? Or like, is there something like, you'd be surprised how many physicists love blank, you know?
You'd be surprised at how much JPL people do outside of work. Actually, rocket scientists and mine, of all my friends, are the ones that are the craziest. They do so much. Like, I have friends who like will go skydiving. A lot of my friends surf. I'm a skier. Everyone I know, I have a friend who rides a unicycle up in the mountains. I mean, my boss biked from SF to LA like a few months ago. I have this other guy I worked with on one of my missions, like, did an Ironman. I would tell you, most people at JPL have something really cool about them.
That's really interesting. And it's probably just because like it's a large enough sample set of people who are very accelerated in a certain field. Genetically, if you're of a level enough to handle being a rocket scientist at JPL, you probably also have aptitudes for other things. Like,
yeah.
I always feel like that. I feel like sometimes when you meet elite level athletes, they're also elite level something else.
Yeah. Because
it's just to get where you are, to get that job you had at JPL, you need such an insane amount of focus and hard work and put in so much time to get your doctorate and all that and passion and stuff. And it's like, if all of a sudden Farah decides like, I'm going to get into cooking lentils. Like, I feel like you might approach it a different way than your average person wants
to cook.
Actually,
I really like baking cupcakes. That's the thing that I do. And my friends are like, and I started one day, I was like, I'm going to learn to bake cupcakes and I'm going to be good at it. And my friends, like, I bake for them and they're like, Jesus, this looks professional. And
I'm I did use a spectrometer to measure the amount of...
And I'm like, no, like, I just learned about it and did it. And then, like, yeah, when I try to make cupcakes, it looks like goop. Make cupcakes and it looks better than, like, what you get from the shop.
Well, like, that's what they say. They also say that baking versus cooking is science versus art, because baking one little ingredient off, it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So, like, cooking a meal, you can kind of like, oops, threw too much pepper in. Well, I'll add a little... But baking is the science version of cooking, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah, and I actually really like baking. I started baking in grad school. Actually, it was a relaxation for me. Like, when I was doing, you know, when I was doing my thesis, I went nuts. I don't know, everyone does in grad school.
I'm sure.
It was so stressful.
What was your thesis on? If I can wrap my head around it.
So basically what I looked at, it was in space systems architecture. So basically it's very early on when we say we're doing a pitch on a mission, we have different options, right? So you tell me like, I have $500 million. What's the best way of me spending that money, right? So I developed tools to help in what we call trade space exploration.
Oh, wow.
Right? So basically it's saying, okay, I'm going to trade different instruments for different costs and, you know, or different amounts of risk. And so they were tools to enable these discussions in real time. And what my thesis particularly focused on was looking at how you could use multi-vehicle systems, so distributed systems, to achieve science goals. So I looked at both spatially distributed systems, so having teams of rovers working together, and how that would maybe distribute risk and help us achieve different goals.
Oh, wow.
And then also spatially distributed, temporarily distributed systems. So basically saying like, well, instead of sending one big mission, what if I sent a smaller mission, figured out some of the high-level questions, and then I was able to send a second mission that's more focused, right? So like, so now that I know what I'm looking at,
that's so cool.
You can send a smaller mission. And so what I did is develop tools to show, well, in these cases, it might be worth it. In these cases, it might not. And, you know, they dealt with some of the technical issues that are associated with that.
That's cool. Now, forgive me if I'm not supposed to talk about this, but those little CubeSats that you were working on, that feels like an extension of that, right?
Well, so I actually never realized that JPL, that like some of the stuff I was working on was like totally related to my thesis, and I just happened to work on them. And then I was like, oh, yeah, I did learn about, like, I did like write a lot of papers about how this is a good idea. So yeah, actually, I can talk about it. So I was working on it, and actually, the CubeSat that I was working on is a perfect example of that.
Right. So, that's right. At least what I gathered from what you said was like, it's not doing everything. It's doing like a more smaller focused kind of one thing, but doesn't cost a lot of as much money or take as much time.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's spreading risk. So just to take one step back, a CubeSat is a very small spacecraft, right? So it has a form factor that is common between a spacecraft. That's how we save money in a way, because we can get a lot of the parts off the shelf. And so, for example, my spacecraft was 10 centimeters by 20 centimeters by 30 centimeters, basically a big cereal box.
Yeah.
And a lot of the parts that we had
Or parts that were already being made
Yeah, like basically we can go to the Home Depot equivalent of spacecraft and be like, hey, I want one of these. There is like a 6 month lead time, but they'll just...
Right. That's something that they already have built before.
Yeah. It's like if you order a water heater.
Yeah.
Same idea. And we're going to order a propulsion system. Right. But kind of that was the idea. It's a product line. And so what we were doing is there was a mission that was meant to launch to Mars in 2016. So in a few months called InSight. It's currently on hold. And that was going to be a lander. And then my little CubeSats were going to fly above and do telecommunication relay. So in that case, you're splitting function, right? So instead of having the functionality of directly being able to talk to Earth from the lander, and this was a tech demo, so the lander was able to get data back to Earth, but we were going to show that, hey, you could fly this little thing that's kind of a relay, like, you know, when you have a cell phone tower that relays data. And it could listen to the smallest signal from the spacecraft, so it doesn't need as big of an antenna, and transmit it back to Earth, right? So yeah, it's actually totally related to my thesis.
And if that were to be successful, there's a lot of other things you could, I think you were explaining with the CubeSats, you could be like,
You could fly those again and it not be a tech demo at that point.
Right, you can just slap a couple extra on a rocket that's already going because they're so small.
Then also we've demonstrated a lot of technology, so now you're reducing risk. So for example, the radio that we're flying, it's a small radio. You can fly on something else or fly it as a backup.
Right,
radio,
and then it might roll into this is how we do things now.
Yeah.
Do you guys... Random aside too, is there like a JPL trivia team that goes to bars and just absolutely crushes?
My friends and I go to trivia. Well, they go every week. I try and go whenever I can. We were there last night. So you'd be surprised though, because you think like, yeah, we're rocket scientists.
It's always pop culture.
Well, so the thing is, we do surprisingly well, but there's also the NPR team. There's a Pasadena NPR team that plays at the same place, and we hate them because it's like, because also they always have an older dude, so he always knows the like pop culture from forever ago.
Oh my god, I want to write a sketch right now that's like the obvious JPL table, the obvious NPR table, and then like four frat brothers who are like, guys, I think we should leave this trivia night.
But it's true, right? But you think like, okay, we're rocket scientists, so we know like a very small area. And actually yesterday there was a question about like Neptune and Apollo, and we were like, yes. And then we're like, oh shit, everyone else knows that too. You'd be surprised on RT. I know nothing. I'll show up because I show up like once a month when I have time, and I didn't grow up in America. If there's a question about French, I'll know that because that's my first language. And I'm like, if you have a question about France or Canada or maple syrup, or like, that's about it, right? Like, maple syrup, guys.
Or systems engineering on.
Yeah, but that they know. Right. So, yeah, we actually do surprisingly well. I think a lot of my friends, and they, you know, their partners will come, and so we get a mix of people. But we do well. We come first or second. We came fifth yesterday.
All right, now, I'd be remiss. My wife would absolutely kill me if I didn't ask this question.
Okay.
Are we alone in the universe?
I hope not.
All right. So that's my answer too, is like, I feel like it would be weirdly self-centered to assume we were.
And like, that would mean that like we were some like weird anomaly essentially.
Right. Oh, right. That we're like an accident
That has to be something. Now, whether we'll find it in our lifetime,
that's all another story.
Right?
Yeah.
So our best bet right now is looking for life in the solar system. That's why we want to go to
Europa. Our own solar system. Yeah. Yes.
That's why we want to go to Europa and Enceladus. And we sort of know that there's no intelligent life, or at least intelligent as we know it. Maybe smarter than you and I, but you know, different life. The problem with getting to these other planets is that they're so far away.
Right.
So we don't actually...
It takes so much time.
So the only way, in my opinion, that we're going to find... I mean, you don't know what's going to happen in terms of technology in the next 50 years, but in my opinion, the only way that we're going to find intelligent life in our lifetime is if they come to us. It's a little scary. They have to be smarter than us.
But, right. That's kind of terrifying.
But
yeah. Unless we make advancements we don't see coming.
Yeah. And I mean,
now we can travel faster.
And who saw the internet coming, right? So you don't know what's going to happen. But
And there is something like, I forget what the terminology is, but like computers are getting exponentially stronger and smaller like every year.
Yeah.
Like a computer from the year before is like the amount of bytes or whatever
it's
handle.
Crazy. And the amount of data that we're storing on the internet, that's exponential too.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
Now it's mostly cat pictures, but yeah.
But hey, those are important too. The kind of shit that we can come up with by investing in science, investing in space exploration, the more shit we learn about and the more we enrich our lives here. I'm getting on some arbitrary soapbox
kind of
right now.
It's philosophical a little bit, right? Yeah. But that's the kind of the argument for investing in science and engineering in general, is that You don't quite know what you're going to discover. Seriously, if we find life, and this is possible, right? We are going to Europa. We are going to continue exploring the solar system. We could find life in our lifetime. Now, how much is that going to tell you about us, right? Because that's really the reason why we're looking for life, is we want to understand how we came to be and how we evolve and how our planet came to be the way it is.
Right.
And so we can study here, which is good, but if we can find places where life has evolved elsewhere, that's going to teach us so much about how life comes to be. And
everyone
asks themselves, like, where am I from?
Yeah. Where are we from? And not on just like a Indian, Madagascar, French Canadian, London.
But
blah,
more
blah.
Like, where are we as a world?
As a concept.
Like, where do we come to be, right? And the question of, are we alone? Even if we find bacteria on another planet,
we're no longer alone.
Oh, yeah. Right?
That's wild. Oh, man. I'm getting so excited. I'm so giddy. And I'm going to do almost nothing to help except...
You can lobby a congressman.
I will do that. And I guess hopefully maybe listeners of this, people who just listen to a podcast for shits and giggles, might get turned on, might get excited by science, because I always have been. And just interviewing three different scientists in three different fields, I've like... JPL specifically is that one makes you feel. There's something very Americana about, you know, very humanist about, let's see what's out there together. I feel like, you know, picture myself like holding my space helmet under my arm and like looking at the horizons going, someday I'll be out there, you know. I feel very, I'm nostalgic for something that hasn't happened yet in some weird way.
Yeah, but I think the years to come are actually going to be amazing because, you know, a lot of people during the Apollo times, that's when a lot of people became passionate about space. And then honestly, we didn't really have a target for a while, right? Like when the Cold War ended, there wasn't a drive to go to space anymore. We did the space station and now it's there.
Right.
We still send astronauts all the time. People will ask me, oh, I thought we didn't have a space program anymore. I thought NASA was canceled. I'm like, no. Do you know the things we do?
Yeah, like my wife said to me, oh, what do astronauts do if they're not? I'm like, some are in space right now.
Yeah.
She's like, there's people in space
and
right now.
And it's actually
people
training to go to Mars. And I think that's really the next exciting thing is that we're really trying to get to Mars.
That's our
again,
moon thing. That's our new
our
moon.
Lifetime.
Yeah.
And you know, we saw Pluto for the first time. Honestly, social media has done wonders for NASA because Instagram pictures of Pluto. Seriously.
But that's
selfies from Mars.
That's really funny using such high science to get, that's like the perfect,
but
the
that's
layman.
That's how you communicate, right? And so like, that's why, like social media is huge. There's a JPL Instagram.
Right. Now people know who, what's his name? Bobak. Everyone knows Mohawk guy. And if that makes three kids want to study more science because of that, but then mission accomplished.
Yeah,
that's great. Yeah. We won't get into
it. And then they realize that, like, oh, they're normal people. Okay.
Right, exactly. It's like they're not all just old, white, balding dudes in lab coats. Like,
yeah, most of us look pretty normal.
Most.
I do have green hair, but yeah.
Yeah. She does have green hair, folks. I'm telling you, you can have, don't listen to your parents. You can have green hair and be
piercings,
a doctor.
And tattoos and be a rocket scientist. It's,
yeah.
It's all
holy
okay.
Crap, you're the full package. That's so awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time
you're
to
welcome.
Talk to me. This was so cool. Oh, sorry for the delay, folks. I was just putting my mind back together. Holy shit, it got blown the F out of my ears. I can't stop thinking about... Did you hear what we were talking about? It's statistically impossible for there not to be life on planets. I mean, people play the lotto because it's a 1 in a billion chance. It's a better chance that there's life on other planets. Sick. Star Trek, Star Wars, it could all be real. Oh, please let there be Tatooine. Oh, I would love to run a moisture vapor on your farm. Wow, sorry. All right, back to business. Look, in these last two episodes, I've learned a lot about myself, whether it's my place in my relationship or my place in the universe. Now, all that's left to figure out is the most important factor in the world, money. And now in this next episode, I'm gonna be talking to a neuroeconomist. Yeah, I've never heard of it either, but that's what excites me. He's gonna explain to me why I've been terrible with money. The answer will not surprise you at all. Thanks again to my producer, Eric Martin. The Layman is a Howl Original and a production of Midroll Media.